Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Our top story this morning, we've learned that both DFW Airport and Love Field refuse to play a video from the Department of Homeland Security.
Hi, I'm Kristi Noem, the United States Secretary of Homeland Security.
So Noem produced this video naming the Democrats as the culprits behind the partial government shutdown, which has been blamed for numerous staff shortages at U.S. airports.
I'm Lauren Berry, and this is On Deadline, where we give you deep dives into top stories from Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the nation. Today, we're going to talk about how the government is in chaos. Don't believe us? Well, we've got just a little bit of evidence. It includes the fact that the government itself is in the third week of a shutdown. Airports are getting clogged because TSA agents are working without pay, which is part of the federal budget, caught up in the crossfire of a showdown between Democrats and Republicans. Both sides of the political aisle are blaming each other for this shutdown. For example, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem recorded a video blaming Democrats for the shutdown. She also ordered U.S. airports to play it on their big screens. Here's how that's going.
Garibaldi's Russell Scott is at Love Field in Dallas. And Russell, we're not going to see this video there?
You're not going to see the video here. A spokesperson for the airport says it won't be seen for two reasons. First, the airport policy prohibits political or issue-oriented content. Second, the airport says they've not received the required permit to run the video. In the video, the Homeland Security Secretary blames Democrats for the government closure.
Democrats in Congress refuse to fund the federal government. And because of this, many of our operations are impacted, and most of our TSA employees are working without pay.
Now, the video is not being shown at DFW Airport either for similar reasons. I talked to several people here in Love Field, and most of the travelers tell me they don't know anything about the video. Others tell me they don't want to get involved and say anything political about any stories right now.
As for the shutdown itself, here's the latest from WWL Radio in New Orleans about where it stands and what it'll take to end it.
We're going to talk about the air traffic control situation now with Brian Stromkowski. He's an assistant director of the Center for Aviation Studies and assistant professor of practice at The Ohio State University. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Tell me what's going on with the government shutdown and air traffic controllers.
So right now, with the government shutdown, the air traffic controllers are considered essential workers by the federal government. So they are still reporting to work every day, and they're still providing excellent service. But at this current moment, they are not being paid for their work.
And how is that affecting the staffing situation?
So by and large, most of the controllers are still showing up and doing their job just as they would on a normal day. But there are some reports out there that there have been an uptick in call offs. And it's hard to know exactly how many. The Secretary of Transportation came out and said it's potentially up to as many as 10%. But it's hard to know because that is a fluid situation.
So take me through the average day of an air traffic controller, if you will. How, they work days, nights, they alternate, how many hours, shifts, how long is a shift, etc.?
So a typical controller, it's hard to say because of the busyness of the airspace. A large urban airspace like New Orleans or New York City, they are going to be 24/7 around the clock.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these smaller markets, they may only be during the day and then into the evening hours, and they might slow down quite a bit overnight, and it might go down to more of like a skeleton crew type situation. Mm-hmm. But they're generally working 8-hour shifts.
In front of a screen for 8 hours?
They do have some breaks in there, so they do have some mandatory rest periods where they're on the screen or looking out the windows, looking at the airport traffic for an hour or two at a time, and then they go get a little bit of a rest break, get to decompress, and then they come back.
Are they primarily looking out of the window? Are they looking at radar screens, both?
It depends what type of facility that they're at. The typical air traffic controllers that most people think of are the ones that are up in the tower and they're monitoring the airport. So they're actually looking out the window, getting eyes on each of the aircraft that's on the runway. There are other types of controllers that work in different facilities. One of them is called an air route traffic control center. And these are the controllers that your pilot is talking to as they're going a longer distances across the country. The center controllers will go for a few hundred miles instead of just the local airport area.
Look, in no way am I attempting to say that what I do is the same as being an air traffic controller, but I got a lot of different elements going on here between 6 and 10 every morning, and I got to tell you, I'm pretty wiped come 10 o'clock because of so many different things, inputs, this, that, decisions here, there, that, the other thing, and I got to believe that after 8 hours, that's a lot for an air traffic controller. I'd have thought maybe a four-hour day would be it, but not necessarily, huh?
The research has shown that this is completely safe. Air traffic control system, this is how we've operated for many, many decades. And it really just comes down to the research that's been conducted by not only the FAA, but other academic institutions that have been out there.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
So I guess they got some help too, right? With a lot of, has it advanced a lot with technology in the last 10, 20 years where air traffic control is, I hate to say, easier than it was before, but maybe less stressful?
Yeah, I don't want to put the word easier on it, yeah. But technology definitely does help. Some of the processes have been automated. Right now, they are trying to get more congressional funding. Congress just authorized, I believe it was $12 billion just in the last month to upgrade the air traffic control system. And Secretary Duffy is trying to get an additional $18 billion to complete the job.
So when it comes to longevity of career, how long do these people last in this, generally speaking? Can you do this for 20 years? Can you do it for 30 years?
Typically, it's around 25 years. You have to start your job by 30, and mandatory retirement is 55.
And do people generally make it to 55 or not?
Generally speaking, yes, most people will make it to 55 years old. And the reason they have that entry and that exit is because the FAA pays for all of your training. So they want to get the 25 years of service out of you.
Do we have a shortage, Professor? And if so, how'd we get there?
We do have a shortage right now. This has been a systemic problem for about a decade. And current reports show that we're somewhere around 2,500 to 3,500 controllers short at this given time.
So that translates into what for the flying public?
It just translates into a little bit of staff shortages within each of the different facilities that are around the country, and possibly some just overtime opportunities for the controllers themselves. But as far as safety is concerned, safety is not degraded with that amount of shortage.
Has the government shutdown made things worse? Are people quitting or just hanging in there? What's the story?
So right now, you are seeing a slight uptick in the controller call-offs, but by and large, most of them are still coming into work. Reports say it's somewhere maybe around 10% of an uptick in call-offs.
Is there a lot of burnout when it comes to this occupation or not? Do people think they're going to be an air traffic controller and then after a couple of years on the job say, I can't do this anymore?
I mean, that does happen. Just like any career field out there, you will get some burnout. But by and large, most controllers, once they go through the training and they reach their facility, they stay with it for their career.
So who pays them? The federal government pays them? They're federal employees that work at the airports, right?
Yes. Yeah. For the most part, it is they are federal employees, and they are assigned to whatever their facility is, either an airport or one of the radar facilities that are across the.
Do you think the average person that gets on a plane realizes the importance of the air traffic controller? Because they always think about the pilot, right, and they think about the aircraft. But do you think they realize the importance of the air traffic controller when it comes to safe travel in a country?
I mean, the air traffic controllers are really the unsung heroes of the aviation system. They do an impressive job. Collectively, they handle 50,000 aircraft across this country every single day. And by and large, we have a very, very small incident rate with these aircraft. So they really are critical to the entire system.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar says the only way this shutdown will end is for President Donald Trump to get personally involved. So why hasn't he done that already? Here are some clues. He does have the power of the purse legally when Congress is out. And the president is using this time, as the Associated Press reported, to give his budget office rare authority to choose who gets paid or fired, which programs are cut or which programs survive, and to restructure the federal workforce to his liking without anyone standing in the way. The president calls his budget chief, Russell Vutt, the, quote, grim reaper. And this reaper has seized the opportunity to fund Trump's priorities, like paying the military while slashing federal roles in health, education, the sciences, and other areas. Speaking during an event at the White House, Trump added, "We're being able to do things that we were unable to do before." Still, there are those travel woes, and worse to come, with a non-functioning government. Democrats and Republicans have dug in their heels over health care. In the Trump budget, it could cost people millions more because of sunsets of some Obamacare subsidies. Here's more on that.
Where are we on the shutdown? And do you think any deal is going to be reached anytime soon?
Well, let's be clear. We're, what, on day 15? Of the government shutdown. And I think it's beginning. It's absolutely ridiculous. The compromise bill that we passed was the CR. That was a massive compromise for a number of conservative Republicans, and I include myself in that, who wanted to see pre-pandemic numbers of spend. We compromised.
Well, I did want to touch on these Obamacare subsidies, I believe, is the language. I do understand that you and many of your Republican colleagues have said that your concerns are this is funding health care for illegal immigrants. As you know, Democrats are pushing back on that, saying that that's an exaggeration. That's not exactly where it is. But what I want to know from you is, where do you come down on any discussion on extending the subsidies? Is that something you're willing to discuss if the government reopens?
Yeah, I think the subsidies the discussion has to be around what have the subsidies done to the cost for American people for their health care. But at the same time, you've seen the remarkable increase in profits made by health insurance companies of 230%, all while denying Americans 30%. Now, actually, it's 33%, a full third of all the claims they deny. So where are these subsidies going? Are they going to actually get health care for American families? So the conversation has to be around, how are we actually providing health care, not health insurance that most Americans at this point in time are having a hard time even being able to afford, but how can we actually provide health care to those who don't have coverage? And how can we prevent the insurance companies from absolutely taking advantage to any kind of subsidies that the government gives and make sure it's going where it needs to go? That's the conversation that we need to have.
As if that's not enough of a multi-pronged battle, the White House started yet another war with the press this week. President Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth set new restrictions on press at the Pentagon. The new rules would prohibit reporters from obtaining or using unauthorized material, regardless of its classification. President Trump also suggested moving the White House press corps out of the White House complex. Here's KCBS Radio in the Bay Area with more.
by CBS News Pentagon reporter Eleanor Watson. Eleanor, good morning. Let's take a step back. First of all, what are these rules proposed by the Pentagon?
Well, good morning, Steve. Yep, the rules, it's been two sets of rules that the Pentagon has put out. The first one received wide condemnation, so they revised it, but that didn't limit the concerns. Some of the rules in there ask for the press to sign an understanding that they will not solicit information from officials about information that has not been publicly released by the Defense Department, which raises a lot of concerns as journalists, because what does soliciting information mean? Does that mean we can't do our jobs and ask questions? So the several organizations have said publicly that they're not going to sign it. CBS News hasn't announced a decision, but the Pentagon Press Association has said that all the press corps of the Pentagon are concerned about the language in these rules.
That is particularly concerning because a major tenet of journalism is cultivating sources, not all of whom are official sources.
That's right. Yeah. And I think the public, the military service members, their families, and the taxpayer, the Defense Department is the largest government agency with the largest budget. They deserve to know information about what the Defense Department is doing. And if that is only going to be brought to them by what the Defense Department wants to be released, then there is concern that what's going on behind closed doors, and journalists won't sign on to only reporting on information the Defense Department wants the people to see.
So all of these agencies, the Times, the AP, Newsmax, the Post, the Atlantic, Reuters, and others, will they be evicted from their desks at the Pentagon?
Yes. We face a deadline of today to decide whether or not to sign on to these new rules. And then if not signing, have to move out by tomorrow. There's some negotiations because some of the outlets like CBS have been in there for, you know, close to eight decades. So it will take some time to move out. But as soon as we don't sign or make the decision on whether or not to sign, there will be move-outs, evicted from the correspondence corridor. And that's something I want to mention, Steve. The Defense Department has painted this as, oh, this is a common sense policy of we won't allow reporters to access to classified spaces anymore. That's never been the case. Reporters have worn badges inside the Pentagon, have walked around the Pentagon in unclassified spaces. Everything that is classified is off limits to us. So this policy that they're presenting as a common sense policy, they're really mischaracterizing what we've agreed to for decades.
I guess I have to ask, what about the First Amendment, which says, you know, government shall not infringe on a free press?
That we will see where the outlets go with that, because as of now, we're facing this quick deadline. The memo was put out 2 weeks ago with a two-week deadline. The agencies have tried to work with the Pentagon on revising the language and now are being pushed out at the deadline. But I don't know that that's going to be the end of the conversation about these rules.
No, I bet it won't be. Now, you can still report on the Pentagon, but you just won't be inside, which I would imagine makes your job a lot tougher.
It makes it tougher in a sense of, when there is a crisis, it does help to be inside the building, and that doesn't just help our reporting. It helps the Pentagon, because if there is some misinformation out there or if there is some big event, it is beneficial to them to get information to us as quickly as possible so we can get it out to the American people and prevent any more misinformation. That will go away with this system, but we will still report on the Pentagon. And what people don't realize is that, you know, the Defense Department is massive. It's not like we're going to be without sources. A lot of the sourcing wasn't even inside the Pentagon in the first place, but it will make that information flow from the Defense Department to the press to get what they need out there in times of a conflict or times of misinformation. It will make that harder.
All right, Eleanor, thank you. That's CBS News Pentagon reporter Eleanor Watson.
As we've been reporting, there have been increasing calls to close, fully close, national parks during the ongoing government shutdown. This comes as nearly two-thirds of park staff have been furloughed this year. For more on this, we're joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by Emily Thompson. She is Executive Director for the Coalition to Protect America's National Parks. Emily, thanks for joining us. So we are seeing or hearing reports about increasing illegal activity, specifically at Yosemite. What have you been seeing? What can you tell us?
Yeah, you know, our national parks, they're already in crisis, and this government shutdown is just making a bad situation worse. We've got, as mentioned, most of our national parks open and accessible to the public, but without the required staff from the National Park Service to help protect visitors and keep the resources safe. It's a dangerous and problematic situation.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. The Chronicle is reporting that there is base jumping happening, as well as unpermitted climbing of El Capitan and Half Dome. And then squatting, people occupying campgrounds that were reserved by other campers, and they claim that since they got there first, they could camp there. What's your reaction to those reports?
Yeah, I mean, this is what we've warned about. This is why we, you know, are working with our members and former national park leaders and employees who have been through shutdowns, who have seen impacts from folks having accessible access to parks and not having enough staff. And, you know, we sent a letter to Secretary Burgum prior to the government closing saying if the government's going to be shut down, so should our national parks. And these kind of dangerous activities and harm to resources and national parks is what we were talking about.
How about garbage and vandalism? Those seem to be the big concerns the last time this happened in between 2018 and 2019. How's the garbage doing so far?
Yeah, piling up from what we understand. I mean, you know, impacts are different at national parks across the country, but we're hearing reports of garbage piling up of, you know, because restrooms are closed, human waste being on trails and where it shouldn't be. We've had reports of people hiking or vehicles and in sensitive habitat areas and being off-road where they shouldn't be. In some cases, you know, damage can take years, if ever, to repair to some of these places.
A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration's move to fire workers during the government shutdown. That ruling coming down this morning. U.S. District Judge Susan Ilston in San Francisco issued the emergency order today. And for more on this, we're joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by Rory Little, professor at UC College of the Law. So tell us about this ruling. What did the judge decide?
She is, like many judges, trying to hold the Trump administration accountable to follow whatever the law is. And the law generally requires congressional acts or requires executive branch following congressional acts before things happen. So, you know, Judge Ilston is a careful judge. She's an experienced judge. I have to assume that she has looked at whatever the statutes are that apply. And she has said, I'm going to give it a temporary pause until we can hear more about it. A TRO only lasts for up to 14 days. And I'll receive more briefing on the issue. You know, the idea is that the Trump administration can't just fire people without some kind of congressional authorization. And this, my guess is she has decided this is contrary to certain personnel rules, and it's also avoiding various congressional funding statutes that have been said to apply.
Okay, just by way of background, the Trump administration has said it would fire more than 4,000 federal employees across 8 agencies during the government shutdown. And is the Trump administration's argument that it is legal because there's a shutdown?
Well, you know, the Trump administration has taken the position that Article 2 of the Constitution gives the executive, and the president is the executive, power to do anything he wants unless you stop him. Apparently he's saying, well, because there's a shutdown, we have to cut costs, and this is one way I'm going to cut costs. Now, whether this is an appropriate way to cut costs or whether this is basically bounded by labor law and union regulations, you know, the plaintiffs in this case are union representatives of unionized federal workers who say, well, we have all sorts of procedural protections in statutory language before you can just fire us. And the shutdown is not one of the reasons that the statutes say.
So what happens next? Will it go back to her court, Judge Ilston's court, after 15 days?
Well, yes. The answer is that, yes, she will continue to have jurisdiction and look towards a preliminary injunction or a trial. On the other hand, the pattern of the Trump administration has been to immediately appeal anything that goes against them. They will, I would imagine, almost immediately ask her for a stay. If she denies a stay, they will go to the Ninth Circuit on some sort of emergency motion basis and ask the Ninth Circuit to stay this ruling. And you know, they could go beyond that to the Supreme Court, but the pattern has been for federal courts to, you know, in a sort of ideologically divided way, uphold the stay of these sorts of orders, which would mean the firings would go forward. If later found to be illegal, you might try to reverse them. They have a case pending this term about what's the right remedy. If it's, let's say the firing is illegal, does that mean you can just reinstate people, or do they just get damages? That's a big case that's going to be decided in the next few months at the Supreme Court.
Okay, but for now, these 4,000-plus federal employees will keep their jobs and they will not be fired because of this stay.
Or at least keep their paychecks coming in. There's a lot more complications to this than just the firing of these people. The question is, what funds are available? What does the shutdown do to paychecks, et cetera, et cetera?
At home, there's warring political parties and the airport logjam and the battles over free speech and the press. Abroad, there's a whole different kind of chaos. And chaos, thy name, is tariffs. Here's the latest from WCCO in Minneapolis on the tariff roller coaster and China's reaction to it.
New this morning, trade tensions with China increasing as both countries are imposing new tariffs, and that is affecting Wall Street. They are reacting with a sell-off here at the opening bell. For a couple of reasons, CBS News Money Watch correspondent Kelly O'Grady.
China was the one that reignited the trade war by putting those export restrictions on rare earth minerals. But you're seeing this visceral market reaction for two reasons. We haven't seen the runaway inflation yet from that 30% existing tariff on China. Now that he's threatened an additional 100% tariff, that's going to be really hard for businesses to eat. And so the Federal Reserve might look at the situation and go, hey, we can't do those interest rate cuts.
The he she's referring to is President Trump.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of On Deadline. It was written and produced by Christy Strouser and by me. You can listen to On Deadline or subscribe to the show on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.